Okay, welcome again. This is Great Decisions, Part 7, The Struggle for a Jewish State, the Haganah, the Irgun, and the Lefi, sponsored as always by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. The State of Israel was established amid unprecedented turmoil and unimaginable horror, decades of legal and illegal activities, the Holocaust, the conflicts with the British mandatory authorities, with the local Arab population, and with the Arab world generally. The three groups that vied for leadership, or at least tried to play effective, meaningful roles, at times they work together, at times they're at bitter odds with each other. Those groups not only succeeded in founding the Jewish state, but in then shaping its history for the next 50 years, and in some ways, even until today. All three were related, in a sense. The Lehi, Lochamei Chayrut Yisrael, Fighters for the Freedom of Israel, was an outgrowth, a breakaway from the Etzel, their Irgun Tzva'i Le'umi, the national military organization, which itself split from the Haganah. So we have to examine the origins of all three and understand the grounds for the splintering of the Jewish self-defense movements in order to explore what each accomplished, and especially what would lead an individual Jew living in that time to join one particular movement or another, or at least support one particular movement or another. It's worthwhile to note, before we start, there are two other possibilities, movements in essence, that existed, that tempted people, that had supporters, but because of the nature of their ideology, played a very limited role in the creation of the state, but both groups, in a sense, still linger until today. One was originally known as the Brit Shalom, the Covenant of Peace, founded by Jewish intellectuals, or that's how they call themselves, Jewish intellectuals in 1925, that renounced the Zionist dream of a Jewish state, but wanted a binational state with Arabs and peace and coexistence, and love and friendship and all good things. So their Zionism was cultural, not political, in a sense an outgrowth of Ahad Ham's philosophy. Major figures were Arthur Rubin and Martin Buber and others. It was an insignificant group that lacked numbers and real support, but because of the personalities involved, Hebrew University President Judah Magnus was also a supporter. It had access to the media and the illusion of influence, but it did exist. It died already in the 1930s. It was resurrected by Magnus under the name Ichud less than a decade later, but also not accomplishing anything. But the binational supporters amongst the Jews don't die easily. An ember of this group was resurrected in the early 2000s, and then it merged with J Street when that anti-Israel group was founded in 2008. The second group, the second other movement, in a sense, were the anti-Zionists, including the Briskarov, who, like many among the old Yishuv, opposed independence. Some for ideological reasons involving Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel before Mashiach, and some, like the Briskarov, for practical reasons. They feared the Jews in Israel would be massacred, and they did not want another Holocaust so soon after the first. How much sway this group had, we'll examine next week. Really not much. Echoes of both still exist until today. The supporters of binationalism have been revived by the increased vulnerability of Israel in the wake of the Oslo debacle, and the anti-Zionists, or the non-Zionists, who still fear world pressure and massacres and the destruction of the lives that they've created in Israel, they still exist also. Nonetheless, the main players in the pre-state drama were the three groups, each of which incidentally numbered religious Jews among their members. So how did these groups arise? Now, so at this point, I was going to play the video, which essentially set the stage with the British mandatory authorities after World War II showing even less sympathy for the Jews than before the war. A change in government, Clement Attlee became prime minister, Ernest Bevin became the foreign minister, and they maintained the ban the restrictions on immigration, and they really spawned the major activities of the three groups after the war period of unity, and then division, and then unity again, and then, sad to say, division again. But let's look, therefore, at the three groups. The Haganah had the most natural and understandable beginnings, as its name implies. Jewish settlements were attacked by Arab marauders almost as soon after they were founded, leading to the establishment in 1909 of a group simply called Hashomer. Hashomer did what the name implied. It guarded the settlements. After World War One, in which Jews had fought in a variety of capacities, among other reasons, to gain experience for the wars ahead in Israel, Zev Jabotinsky tried to establish a Jewish defense group more formal than Hashomer, but he was thwarted by the British. The riots of 1920 were a wake-up call to the Jews. Tens of thousands of Arabs attacked mainly the Jews of the old yeshuv in the old city. A handful were killed, hundreds were wounded, many more evacuated, and the Jews were not allowed to defend themselves. When Jabotinsky met the mandatory governor Storrs and suggested that his informal group be mobilized, he was not only denied permission, but on the spot he was arrested for possession of a pistol, and he was sentenced to 15 years in prison. In the end, he served one, but he was banned from the country thereafter. Now, volunteers did appear during the 1920 riots to fight back. One of them was Nechemya Rabin, who was later Yitzhak's father. But the Jews then realized that something more organized would be necessary, as the British would be of no help encountering the Arab violence of the future and might even hinder Jewish self-defense. Indeed, when Storrs apologized to Menachem Ussishkin, who was then chairman of the Zionist Commission, for what he called the tragedy, Ussishkin asked, "What tragedy?" That was a pogrom. When Storrs protested, pogrom implies some government connivance, Ussishkin, the Russian-born Ussishkin, responded, "You, Colonel, are an expert on matters of management, and I am an expert on the rules of pogroms." And it was a pogrom because the British either stood by doing nothing, or prevented the Jews from responding, or in some cases even actively helped the Arabs. All of which led to the clandestine founding in March 1921 of the Haganah, meaning defense, with the understanding that it would be responsible for security in the entire yeshuv, and not just for individual settlements. The Histadrut became the overseer of the Haganah. Weapons were acquired illegally from Europe, and officers' training courses were held in secret. It was first tested in May 1921 in Yafo, the riots there, and then again in 1929, and the massacres in Hebron and the fighting in Yerushalayim led the new leaders, David Ben-Gurion and Chaim Arlozorov, to increase conscription and training and weapons procurement as well. It wasn't an easy ride. Nothing is ever simple. The Zionist Congress, in fact, split over the idea of whether to have a formal fighting force, with the general Zionists less than eager about giving the socialist Histadrut a monopoly on security and defense matters. Nor did the Haganah provide much defense during the riots, as it turned out. The Haganah always had a very partisan edge from the very beginning, because it was the tip of the spear of the Histadrut. So, for example, in one very celebrated and infamous case, one of the more articulate spokesmen for the old yeshuv, a very strange but charismatic Dutch Jew named Yaakov Dahan, he had attached himself to the anti-Zionist Eda Haredis, and he was tasked in 1924 with persuading the British to allow the old yeshuv to detach itself officially and politically from the Zionist establishment, similar to what the German Jews under Avershe had done in the 19th century. He was assassinated on June 24th, 1924, before the meeting with the British by the Haganah. Not only was an assassin identified many decades later, Moshe Tehomi, but in the 1980s, he lived in California for a long time, died there in Hong Kong when he gave the interview. He admitted it was done on direct orders of Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who later became Israel's second president. Add to that the still unsolved murder of Chaim Arlozorov, Ben Gurion's rival, in 1933. It was blamed on two revisionists, but with numerous other suspects over the years, including the Haganah, so that added to Jabotinsky's concerns about the Haganah itself, even though he had already formally split with the Zionist movement. By 1936, the Haganah had taken the form of a paramilitary organization and even been accepted by the British. Its commander, Yitzhak Sadeh, a committed Marxist who had fought in the Red Army, pioneered the aggressive tactics of the Haganah, planned ambushes, mobile patrols, striking first at the Arab terrorists, all of which remain until today. Now, he in the late 30s was bolstered by the presence of Ord Wingate, who was assigned to the Haganah by the British, who were unaware that Wingate was a Protestant millennialist, what we call today, and then too, but it was a half century gap, a Christian Zionist. He was a passionate supporter of Zionism. Wingate emphasized swift patrols, night operations, what he called an active defense that in theory exists until today. And if you look at Israel's wars, Israel's been most successful when it continues to implement Wingate's tactics, and it's been most unsuccessful when it's had to deviate either behind a static defense line or by holding large swaths of territory of enemy population, where in fact these types of tactics of surprise and patrols, etc., don't really have that much effect. That concept of active defense was challenged by another strategic concept that was first implemented in 1936, was last carried out just a few days ago, and that directly led to the creation of the Irgun. So the progenitor of the Irgun was called the Haganah Bet. It was founded in 1931 by the aforementioned Avram Tehomi, who broke away from the Haganah after its failures in 1929. He served as the first commander. It was later influenced by Jabotinsky's Beitar movement that was based in Europe and provided, among other things, rudimentary military training, although the Israel version did not come under Jabotinsky's command and control until 1937. The name Etzel Irgun Tzva'i Lumi dates from Tehomi's time, from the early 1930s, and it was intended to contrast with the Haganah. Haganah's defense, purely defense. Irgun Tzva'i Le'umi is a military organization, meaning they saw their role as not only defending what exists, but taking the war to the enemy if necessary. What led to the open rift, what I mentioned a moment ago, was the Haganah's response to the Arab riots of 1936 to 1939, known as Havlaga, restraint. Arabs began rioting, attacking trains and farms, bombing markets, all designed to intimidate the Jews, period, and to intimidate the British into halting Jewish immigration, which, as you remember, reached a sort of climax in the mid-1930s. Within 6 months, in the latter half of 1936, about 80 Jews were killed, hundreds were wounded. At first, in response to the riots, both organizations, the Haganah and the Irgun, did not respond. The Irgun even considered disbanding and rejoining the Haganah. Many of its members did, like Tehomi, but others stayed and revamped and finally accepted Jabotinsky's leadership and went on a campaign to renounce the policy of Havlaga. Now, what's the theory of restraint? Why would they do it? I mean, again, it exists in our time. Every time rockets land on Israel and draw no response, essentially they're implementing this policy of restraint. Part of the theory of restraint was the Jewish agency's desire to show support for the British, who were trying to suppress the riots. Indeed, thousands of Arabs were killed during those 3 years in the conflict, and Ben-Gurion always felt the real struggle was with the British and not the Arabs. And restraint would hopefully, eventually, win British support for a Jewish armed force. And he feared, Ben-Gurion did, that if there was a civil war between Jews and Arabs, the British would completely stop immigration altogether. The downside of Havlaga, then and now, is that it encourages the Arabs. It whets their bloodlust. And then also, like today, did not have the intended effect on the British of guiding them to a more pro-Jewish stance, exactly opposite. The riots led the British to want to accommodate the Arabs more, just to stop the violence, and so they began to sharply limit immigration, all culminating in the 1939 white paper that was designed to end Aliyah completely after 5 years. So the allure of restraint exists today as well, to curry favor, to win international support, not to risk Jewish lives, but in the end the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and the more violent party extracts concessions from the more restrained party. That's why every time Israel's attacked and then accepts the blows and finally responds, when the shooting dies down, Israel's expected to make concessions in order to ensure that there's no further hostilities coming from the enemy. That's the way Havlaga worked then and works today as well. So the Irgun broke away from the Haganah and began to counterattack, with the date officially marked as Black Sunday, November 14th, 1937, the end to Havlaga, and they responded proportionally and exactly as they were attacked. Attacks on Jewish buses and markets were followed by attacks on Arab buses and markets. The deadliest attack, from their perspective, being July 25th, 1938, when 43 Arabs were killed by a bomb placed in the Arab market in Haifa, again responding to a bomb placed in a Jewish market. It was unpleasant, but it worked. Within 2 years, Arab terrorism had stopped, temporarily of course. Some Irgun members then were caught and hanged for their acts, but nonetheless, the battle was joined. The new commander of the Irgun in the late 1930s that began this campaign was a very interesting Jew named David Raziel. He was a great warrior, a religious Jew, a Shomer Shabbos, who made Shmir Shabbos part of the Irgun's organizational doctrine. Even later, years later, Begin writes in his book, The Revolt, the Irgun would never attack on Shabbos. They were a Shomer Shabbos organization, and he writes that the British knew this, and so they were able to relax a little more on Shabbos. And only on two or three occasions of vital military operations did he breach the Shmir Shabbos of the Irgun. One, in fact, was an attack on a British officer's social club when they realized that they thought the Irgun could not attack. Raziel himself was killed during World War II fighting for the British against the Nazis in Iraq. He was succeeded as commander by Yaakov Meridor, later Knesset member, minister in Begin's government. When it was reorganized in 1937, Irgun's new secretary, one of the officers, was a young Jew from Suwałk in Poland named Avram Stern, nicknamed Yair. Now the Etzel engaged in two other activities of significance. In the late 1930s, after the British began restricting immigration, they started the illegal immigration movement. Remember from last time, Jabotinsky was obsessed with what he saw as the looming catastrophe of European Jewry, and he formulated plans to evacuate 5 million Jews from Europe. It wasn't successful in that, but the illegal immigration of the late 1930s did bring 20,000 Jews to Israel. At the time, the Jewish agency shied away from illegal immigration so as not to offend the British. And something else happened in the late 1930s as well. The Irgun began attacking the British also, sensing that the only way to create a Jewish state that would allow unimpeded immigration was to dislodge the British. They began by attacking mainly installations, telephone lines, electricity facilities, and the like. The British, horrified that they now had to deal with Jewish insurgents and Arab insurgents, began to make arrests including of Avram Stern, all of which ended abruptly on September 1st, 1939, when World War II started. And that led to the creation of the third group, which was the second breakaway, and that's Lochamei Chayrut Yisrael, known pejoratively to the British as the Stern Gang. When Stern was in prison, vigorous debates took place as to what should be the loyalty of the Jews in Israel and their long-range objectives. And you could almost hear echoes of the debate because there are very powerful arguments on each side. In the early 1940, just a few months after the war started, the Irgun suspended its operations against the British for the duration of the war, seeing the Nazis as a far greater threat to the Jewish people than were the British. In that sense, they joined together again formally with the Haganah, who were implementing Ben-Gurion's policy, enunciated after the war started, that we will fight the white paper as if there is no war, and we'll fight the war as if there is no white paper. However you slice it, it came down to cooperating with the British. Stern disagreed, and when he was freed from prison in August 1940, he established the Lehi, Lochamei Chayrut Yisrael, that would continue the struggle against the British even during World War II, and even if the Nazis derived an indirect benefit from the weakening of the Brits. Not only that, but in the Lehi, there was such a movement, there were people who made contact with the Nazis in order to work with them, in order to undermine the British. Not realizing, of course, the grave threat the Nazis posed to the Jews of Europe, but nonetheless, in exchange for the German support for a Jewish state, which would embarrass the British, they would have supported the Nazis, but of course nothing came of it, not because of the Jews, but because of the Nazis, Yimach Shmom. For Yair Stern, as he said, I quote, "There's no difference between Hitler and Chamberlain, between Dachau or Buchenwald, and sealing the gates of Eretz Yisrael." To him it was all the same. The Germans were Jew haters, and the British were enemies of the Jewish people. And to him it was a distinction without a real difference. In essence, Jewish self-defense in Israel had now split into three groups, and relations would alternate from cooperation to outright hostility for much of the next decade. There's one other difference also, a very profound difference. Jabotinsky and Stern had always assumed that independence would be won by force, and so they guided themselves on that basis. The establishment, until the late 1940s, always assumed the state would be established through diplomacy and pressure, and they guided themselves accordingly as well. Interestingly, the Lehi was the least political, so to speak, of the three groups. That is to say, the Haganah was roughly left-wing, and the Irgun was roughly right-wing, but the Lehi was a mixed group. And after the war, its leaders split from the far right to the Communist Party. So they were bonded more by the common ideology of a state than by the politics the state would later have. Yair Stern published what he called the 18 Ikare Triya, 18 Principles of Rebirth, of which I have a copy here. We could subscribe to these. Ha'am, Am Yisrael, Am Sgula. The people of Israel are treasured people, the creators of monotheism, Mechokek Musar HaNeviim, and then he goes on, he defined the borders of the Jewish state. What are the borders? We all know, it's the Pasuk in Lech Lecha, Min Nahar Mitzrayim Ad HaNahar Gadol Nahar Pras, from the river of Egypt, from El Arish, until Euphrates. And he said as the ultimate goal, the 18th of his Ikarim, Binyana Bait HaShlishi Kisemel Letar Gula Shlema, the rebuilding of the third Beis HaMikdash. Even though he wasn't a religious Jew, but nonetheless, they were imbued with a very, very deep sense of nationalism. For the Jews of the era, more went into the choice of these three groups than just the politics. Did you support Havlagah? Do you favor a moratorium on the struggle against the British during World War II? There are many elements, many other elements, that kept the membership in the dissident organizations relatively small compared to the Haganah, which of course was controlled by the Jewish agency. In terms of a fighting force, it was very small. The Lehi numbered in the low hundreds, the Irgun maybe in the high hundreds, but even the Haganah was in the low thousands. But there are other differences as well. Ben-Gurion, as we know, was a committed socialist. He saw the triumph of the working man as part of universal redemption. Jabotinsky was a capitalist who favored a strong middle class, free enterprise, the private sector. We cannot underestimate how vehement those debates were a century ago. Hey, I think they're taking place today in America too. There were Jews who were drawn to Jabotinsky's assertiveness, Jewish pride, self-respect, as to his claim that the land of Israel extended to Transjordan as well. Shtei gadot layardein, that Jordan has two banks. One is ours, and the other two. The symbol of the Irgun was the clenched fist, the slogan Rak Kach, which Meir Kahana decades later assumed, over a map of the entire mandatory Palestine, both sides of the Jordan. What's today Israel, what's today Jordan. European Jews, especially after centuries of intimidation and persecution and physical assaults, were more enamored of Beitar than were the Jews living in Israel, where it had support, but not as great, not as passionate as it was in Europe. But that was also attributable to another critical point. The Histadrut controlled people's lives, and did so really until the Begin Revolution in 1977 and thereafter. When I say control people's lives, they controlled jobs and health care and education and apartments and opportunity. You're either in the club or outside the club. And to be outside the club was to subject yourself to personal and financial hardship. So that itself limited the influence of the other movements in Israeli life, which did not have such a capacity to influence people in their daily lives. And also, Ben-Gurion had a long memory, and he had a vengeful personality. Irgun members, for example, were barred from the Histadrut. Revisionists were barred from the Histadrut. Even after Tzahal was formed, many Irgunists and the Irgun and Lehi were disbanded. Many of their fighters were not allowed in the army. Many were deprived jobs. I mean, it's a very common story. So common, it's part of today's narrative. The Prime Minister grew up in America because his father, Ben Sion, who was a professor and a revisionist, was essentially banned from academia in Israel. He couldn't get a job, so he had to come to America to teach. It was hard to get a home, it was hard to get a phone without the right connections. And Ben-Gurion was relentless. How relentless? I'll give you another example. In July 1940, which was a month before Stern went out and formed Lehi, Jabotinsky died in New York at age 60, buried in New Montefiore Cemetery out on the island, with instructions not to be reinterred in Israel except by order of the Jewish government of the Jewish state, which then still was a dream. He was buried on Har Herzl by order of Prime Minister Levi Eshkol in 1964, 16 years after the state was established, because Ben-Gurion never allowed it. He refused to allow on his watch Jabotinsky's body to be returned to Israel. Ben-Gurion never mentioned Begin's name in public. It's very famous. There's a 900-page authorized biography of Ben-Gurion by Shabtai Tevet that just takes up Ben-Gurion's life until 1948. Begin is not mentioned in any substantive way. His name appears only one time. It's as if a Menachem Begin never existed. To Ben-Gurion, he just referred to the dissident movements and their members as the terrorists, and they had no personalities or lives. Certainly from his perspective, that was counterproductive. So the dissident movements in Israel always had relatively few members, especially compared to their successes, but many of their supporters had to remain private, behind the scenes, underground. So the underground had to hide not only from the British, it also had to hide occasionally from the Jews as well. So what was the struggle? The Jewish agency's plan to attract British sympathy by cooperation and by favoring diplomacy over guerrilla warfare was a failure, proven by the white paper before the war and by British reluctance to defend the Jews or allow them to defend themselves after the war. So the elite, Palmach, Plugot Machas, the strike forces, unit was formed in 1941, had a few hundred people. In 1948, it only had 2,000 members. But the British encouraged it at first. Remember, the war had come to the Middle East. The Nazis were in North Africa, heading east through Egypt towards Israel. And the British thought it would be helpful to have a more formalized Jewish armed force helping defend the land. But after El Alamein, where the Nazis defeated, the British ordered the Palmach disbanded because it no longer suited their purposes. Instead, the Palmach went underground, and in the early years, the 40s, they concentrated on illegal immigration. And that's when the Haganah, the Jewish Agency, stepped up in the early war years, trying to bring in Jews illegally. In those early years, only the Lehi fought against the British. Their actions against the British were fairly limited, but they did have several bank robberies. They needed the money. That resulted in deaths, and the British decided to hunt down the leadership. Yair Stern, in fact, was killed, shot in cold blood, unarmed, in an apartment in Tel Aviv, February 12, 1942. The village Kochav Yair is named for him. The group floundered for several months until its future leaders, two of them at least, escaped from British prison. And the Lehi, for the duration of its existence, was governed by a triumvirate, names that ring a bell today as well. Yisrael Eldad, Yisrael Shaib. Yisrael Eldad was the ideological leader. His son, Dr. Aryeh, the Chaver Knesset now from Yichud Lumi, started a new party, Otzma Yisrael, that's running in the election in a few weeks. Natan Yellen Mor, who after the war became pro-Soviet and a radical peacenik, and Yitzhak Shamir, who became prime minister and who named his son Yair after Avram Stern. Yair Shamir, if you don't know, was an IAF pilot and a successful businessman, and as we speak, he's now number two on the Yisrael Beitenu list. I think he's fifth or sixth on the Likud Beitenu list in the upcoming Knesset elections. He's a much taller and thicker version of his father, but other than that, he looks and sounds exactly the same. He's late 60s, he's not a young man, but this is his first foray into politics. Lehi did not recover immediately from Stern's death, nor did the Irgun from Raziel's death in Iraq. It wasn't until Arosh Beitar in Poland arrived in Israel in 1942 as part of the Polish army in exile, newly released from a Soviet labor camp. That, of course, was Menachem Begin. Begin was born in Brisk in 1912, a little over a century ago. The midwife to his birth, you might know, was Ariel Sharon's grandmother. Begin was a natural leader and a natural orator. He was imprisoned by the Soviets after the war started as an enemy combatant. The Soviets were aligned with the Nazis, of course. He was only freed when the Nazis reneged on their non-aggression pact and invaded Russia. Then the Russians freed all their Polish, so to speak, prisoners in order to help them fight. They created an artificial Polish army known as Anders Army, in which Begin was enlisted. They traveled through Persia, made his way to Israel, arrived in May 1942. Immediately, Yaakov Meridor relinquished his position as commander of the Irgun to Begin, but Begin, who was a stickler for protocol, always refused to accept this new command until he was formally discharged from Anders' army. I think he was a private or a corporal, nonetheless made a big fuss that he could not take on because he's serving in the army of another country, and that took until December of 1942 for his official release to come. It was not until 1944, February in fact, when both groups began their attacks on the British. To the perspective of World War II, by early 1944, the Nazis had been routed from North Africa. The campaign in Italy had also borne fruit, and the Allies were marching north through Italy towards the southern part of the Axis, and of course D-Day in June was just a few months away. In 1944, though, because the area of Israel were free from any type of pressure, and the Nazis were on the run, the Irgun and the Lehi began their attacks on the British. The Irgun, when calling for a revolt, still only attacked British military installations. and they said they would not attack soldiers until May 1945. Part of what they used to attack was the radar facilities that were monitoring the illegal immigration. At the same time, the Haganah was actively helping the British, still hoping to reap some post-war benefits. Part of their dilemma, part of their anguish, resulted from the fact that despite the ongoing Holocaust in Europe, the British were still actively preventing immigration in a number of ways. Just think, February 23rd, 1942, a scant 11 days after Jir Stern was killed, the refugee ship, the SS Struma, was torpedoed in the Black Sea. 768 Jews perished in a moment. They were waiting for the British immigration certificates they had been promised to be given to them in Istanbul. The British refused to give it, and for whatever reason, the Russians torpedoed the ship, and all the Jews were killed. It was just symbolic of the attempts by the British to frustrate Jewish immigration, even though the Jews who were being denied admission to the land of Israel would otherwise have been killed by the Nazis. Now, Winston Churchill, who was otherwise sympathetic to Zionism, complained to Chaim Weizmann about these attacks. But Churchill himself was livid when on November 6, 1944, two Lehi members assassinated the British minister in Cairo, Lord Moyne, who happened to be close to Churchill, but was also a rabid Jew hater who strenuously argued against any Jewish immigration to Eretz Yisrael. Both Lehi soldiers were arrested, both executed. 30 years later, they were buried in a national ceremony in Israel. But Churchill denounced the act, and in Parliament he said that he would have to reconsider his support for Zionism if it produces what he said was a new set of gangsters worthy of Nazi Germany. Now, these types of targeted executions are still controversial today, as you might know, both when the Israelis do it in Gaza, for that matter, when the Americans do it in Afghanistan and elsewhere, the drone attacks. But Shamir, who had ordered the attack, justified them as preferable to random attacks or attacks that kill civilians, and he openly questioned why the Moyne assassination was terrorism when just the person they wanted was killed, but the bombing of Hiroshima, for example, was not, when it had over 100,000 civilians killed. In any event, the result of the Moyne assassination was one of the more lamentable and despicable periods in pre-state Israel, the beginning of the saison, the hunting season. For 4 months, November through February, members of the Irgun and Lehi were literally hunted down by the Haganah and handed over to the British. In other cases, it couldn't be found. The British would be given lists of names of Jews that should be arrested, incarcerated, in some cases, exiled. And Jews who were famous were involved, the officers, Moshe Dayan, Teddy Kollek, Yigal Alon, Yisrael Galili, and others as well. Begin himself was not caught. It was then that he went into hiding, almost for the next more than 5 years. One of his disguises, as we know, you can see pictures of him, Rabbi Sassover, he had a beard, and he just went to shul, Shachris Mincha Mairiv. Otherwise he sat and learned, that's what the theory was in his neighborhood. He was just a Kohl student trying to get by. The very interesting story that Begin tells, that once they asked him to come and be an aide for a ksuba, which would entail his writing his name. They knew him with a different name, not Menachem. But if he signed his real name, he'd be exposed potentially. If he signed his false name, then the ksuba is puzzle. Do you know what to do? So in the end, he just didn't show up. And at Shachris the next day, he said, I forgot, I got so busy in my learning, and so I didn't come. Years later, by the way, after the war, some of the Balabatim said they always knew who he was. Some were members of the Irgun, but the code was not to say anything, so they didn't say anything. Begin did not emerge publicly until the day after Yom HaTzmut in 1948. During the saison, though, from his hiding place, Begin gave two orders: not to cease their attacks on the British, and not to resist, not to fight back against the Haganah. In Begin's mind, nothing was worse than civil war, and he held that to be his proudest achievement, despite fierce opposition among his fighters. If you visit the Begin Museum, remember correctly, in the entrance they have that slogan, that is the greatest accomplishment of his life was that on several occasions, this one of them, he prevented Milchemet Achim, a civil war. Ben-Gurion's war and his fellow Jews also cemented, ironically, his position as leader. Everyone else was in hiding, and it weakened any other opposition. Hundreds of Jews, close to 1,000, were arrested, incarcerated, many of them not even Irgun members, but merely revisionists whom Ben-Gurion wanted out of the way. Public pressure entered the Saison, and within a few months after the war, the Irgun was back in business, attacking the British military, bridges, rail lines, supply depots. When the British, now under new management after Churchill lost the election a month after the war, how's that for gratitude? The British resisted calls for Jewish statehood and still opposed immigration, meaning after the war, they renewed the white paper. And they evinced a very sharply pro-Arab bias, so the Haganah for the first time changed policy. And the three groups got together, called the United Resistance Movement, and for the first time, they all fought together, coordinating their attacks on the British. Most famously, their first big attack, June 17, 1946, the Haganah blew up 10 bridges that linked Israel with the surrounding countries, bridges that were important British supply links. Just less than 2 weeks later, Shabbos, June 29th, Black Sabbath in Israel's history, the British began a two-week house-to-house search and arrest mission for Jewish agency or Irgun Lehi figures that were out there. Begin was not discovered. Ben-Gurion was in Paris, but dozens of leading figures were arrested. Many were exiled to Africa, including Shamir. Shamir was exiled to Africa twice during the struggle, and both times he escaped. He's very short, but nonetheless, somehow he made it back from Africa to Israel undetected. As the British upped the ante, so did the Irgun. Within a few weeks, they carried out perhaps the most daring mission of the underground war, the bombing of the King David Hotel on July 22, 1946. In the world, there's much confusion about this. The hotel was not a real hotel. Half of it was, but the other half had been commandeered by the British and served as the British military and administrative headquarters. That was the seat of government of the British, so it's a classic military target. And it was that part of the hotel, the right side of the hotel, as you stand in front, that was blown up using milk cans that were smuggled into the kitchen filled with explosives. And it was payback, because the British had raided the Jewish agency just a few blocks away on Black Sabbath and seized documents and used those documents to track down the leaders and Haganah figures. There were two unfortunate consequences of the attack on the King David Hotel. First, the British ignored phoned warnings, which was a tactic of the Irgun. They refused to evacuate the building, even with 30 minutes notice, and so 91 people were killed, including 17 Jews. Additionally, the Haganah, which had approved the attack, Moshe Sneh, the commander of the Haganah, personally approved it. Nonetheless, they condemned it afterwards, pretending they didn't know about it, saying it was, I quote, a base and unparalleled act perpetrated today by a gang of criminals. Aye, they were part of the gang of criminals. It didn't matter. And that would become another despicable pattern in order to blacken the underground movements, to curry favor with the authorities, and to win support among the population. The British, though, took note, and no doubt these attacks, especially the King David Hotel, got their attention. They first ordered a general curfew on the population that can't be sustained for that long. Then they ordered their soldiers to avoid fraternizing with Jews or patronizing their stores. The infamous General Barker said, we have to strike at their pockets. Their race dislikes that. Meaning if you don't shop in their stores and they lose money, then the Jews will come around. But pretty soon the British tired of the whole mandate business itself. Once again, when that happened, the Haganah turned on its erstwhile allies. Meanwhile, the pressure was kept up. From September 1946 until independence, Lehi carried out more than 100 acts of sabotage and murder the Irgun even more. Lefi had no qualms about attacks that killed civilians, while the Irgun scrupulously avoided them. There were attacks on police stations, on officers' clubs, retaliation against Arabs. There was the hanging of two British sergeants outside of Netanya in response to the execution of Irgun members. Was a daring escape from the Akko prison, May 4th, 1947, that freed about 40 Irgun Lehi operatives, among them Eitan Livni, who was before his arrest the Irgun's head of operations, Tzipi Livni's father, although she has apparently strayed from his path. The Haganah spearheaded the illegal immigration, most famously with the voyage of the SS Exodus, which docked in Haifa in July 1947, was turned back, galvanized the entire yeshuv and the world in support of the Jewish refugees. Nobody liked the way Paul Newman was treated. The British looked bad. It was turned over to the UN, the whole Palestine problem, and after the partition plan was adopted, the targets shifted. It was bitterly opposed. Partition was bitterly opposed by both the Irgun and the Lehi, with Begin terming it then and subsequently illegal. We have no right to waive part of the Jewish homeland. Partition granted the Jewish state slivers of land along the coast and in the Galil and much of the Negev and no Yerushalayim. So once again, the three groups began cooperating and coordinating their battles, but now against the Arabs, since the end date of the British was known. The Irgun was instrumental in the battles for Yafo, the Haganah vastly superior in manpower and weaponry in the Galil, in the settlements, in the road to Yerushalayim. Both main groups fought in the Yerushalayim area. Now, in one major and infamous operation, Irgun and Lehi forces combined to capture an Arab village, Deir Yassin, that was not far from the main highway to Yerushalayim, and for which point raids had been conducted on convoys heading to Yerushalayim. What do we call Deir Yassin today? Arnof. Arnof was built, part of it at least, on Deir Yassin. On April 9, 1948, 120 Irgun and Lehi fighters, a small force, entered the village early in the morning. To their surprise, they encountered fierce resistance and had to go house to house fighting. They suffered casualties approaching 40% of the attacking force, an astounding ratio. 120 people, 5 dead, 40 wounded. They had to, in the end, just throw grenades into houses from which shooting was coming. Too dangerous to enter. In the end, more than 100 Arabs were killed, including women and children, and word quickly spread of a massacre. That report was abetted once again by the Haganah leadership that had approved the operation, but then pretended to know nothing about it, and the stories were embellished. Massacres, looting, rapes of women, etc. There were three immediate consequences of Deir Yassin. Just a few days later, April 13th, 4 days later, in retaliation, the Arabs massacred a convoy of doctors and nurses heading to Hadassah Hospital on Har Tzofim. 79 were killed, but only 30 bodies were recovered. The rest were burnt to ashes on the buses that were sprayed with gasoline and then set on fire, evoking for the Jews horrible memories of the Holocaust. Secondly, the reputation of the Irgun was permanently blackened, and that shaped the politics of Israel for generations. And thirdly, and probably in context most importantly, the massacre report sparked a wave of panic among the Arabs, who now thought that the Jews would do to them what they're planning on doing to the Jews, and they began to flee in large numbers. One of the two main causes of the Arab refugee flight. The other was the request by the Arab commanders that the local population leave so they will not be harmed during the planned extermination of the Jews. As one Arab said a few years later, they were told, "Get out so we can get in." But they never got in, and so he was a refugee. Begin later wrote, despite the libel, I quote, "The legacy of Deir Yassin was worth a half dozen battalions to the forces of Israel. Panic overwhelmed the Arabs. That panic is credited with saving Tveria and conquering Haifa, among other things." May 14th, 1948, statehood was declared, but the dissident groups did not immediately disband. That was because Yerushalayim was not part of a Jewish state pursuant to the partition plan. And thus the three groups remained there to fight unofficially. They even fought together in the old city and surrendered together as well. After the first ceasefire, a subsequent plan to have the groups attack different gates of the old city failed. Only Irgun was able to hold its position, and that's why Israel controlled Hatzion after 1948. Part of the problem they had was the difficulty in getting arms to Yerushalayim or even into Israel under the terms of the first ceasefire, which banned the importation of weapons. Of course, it limited the Jews but not the Arabs, and that led to another trauma of these groups. The Irgun had contracted to bring a ship with weapons from Paris, the Altalena, and it set sail after the ceasefire went into effect. Now, Begin had agreed with Yisrael Galili that 20% of the arms would go to the Irgun forces in Yerushalayim, and the rest would go to the Haganah to divide as they wished, but he felt he owed it to his fighters to get them weapons. Ben-Gurion reneged on the agreement after the ship started unloading, started ranting about Begin trying to overthrow the government, and ordered his men, coincidentally, ironically, it was Yitzhak Rabin, who's the commander on site, ordered his men to open fire. About 30 Irgunis were killed on ship and shore. 3 Haganah soldiers were killed. Once again, Begin ordered his men not to respond, not to fight back. He himself was on board when the shooting began, and of course the reports that persist that Begin opened fire in order to kill Begin, as much as he hated him. Even worse, one book written, I guess, 20 years ago, revealed that, allegedly, Ben-Gurion ordered Israel's nascent air force to sink the ship while it was still at sea. And he tried to induce 3 non-Jewish pilots, volunteers, to carry out the mission. They refused the orders, saying they hadn't come to Israel to kill Jews, but to help Jews. The aftermath of the Altalena, numerous members of the Irgun and Lehi were arrested, detained for almost 2 months, but shortly thereafter, the organizations disbanded. The Irgun, the Lehi, disbanded. Some of the members that I mentioned were not allowed into the IDF. Others were. Interestingly enough, the Palmach also refused to disband. They want to remain a force. And Ben-Gurion exercised his will, which was resolute. There's only one army with one commander, and the Palmach also merged with the rest of the army, but the bitterness remained. Veteran Irgunis became pariahs. Begin began a long career in opposition, never achieving much electoral success until 1977. Oddly enough, all three heads would eventually become prime minister. Ben-Gurion first, then Begin from 1977 to 83, and then Shamir, who first, again, being a pariah, was not allowed into government or any official position, entered business, and then after 10 years, apparently the moratorium, he entered the Mossad, where he served as the station chief in Paris. He became prime minister for several terms in the 80s and the 1990s. It has to be emphasized, from my perspective at least, all three groups were critically important in the drive for statehood. Without the Jewish agency and the Haganah, there would not have been the infrastructure for a state. Diplomacy was critical in attracting world support. If there had been only armed resistance, the British would have eventually crushed it, because their forces, they had 100,000 troops, their forces outnumbered the fighters probably 10 to 1. But if there had been only diplomacy and no armed resistance, independence also would not have been achieved. The British would just ignore the pleas of the British agency like they'd done for 20 years already. So to be toothless is as useless as to be spineless. So all three groups earned the eternal gratitude of the Jewish people if only they had been able to work together. Who knows what might have happened? Well, the divisions always remained between those, and still remain, between those who see restraint as a virtue, those who see it as a vice, between those who wish to rely on the support of allied nations and those who wish to be self-reliant, those who will turn on Jews and those who will avoid civil war at all costs. Those who want Israel to chart its own destiny, and those who see its fate as intertwined with other nations. Between those who wish an economy in which the means of production are controlled by government and prosperity is limited, and those who wish to embrace free enterprise, private investment, and capitalism. All those still exist until today. In fact, it's remarkable how the pre-state struggle of the Haganah, the Irgun, the Lehi, colors events until today, and how each group finds its ideology still represented, albeit loosely, in some of the political parties still extant and still competing. Some Jewish arguments never end, as we know, and the choices people made then echo the choices they still make, and in some sense, the choices Israelis will make when they go to the polls again in 2 weeks. I thank you all very much. Next week, we're going to look at a very critical event, and probably Ben-Gurion's finest hour, the decision to declare statehood, which in retrospect to us seems obvious, but at the time was not at all obvious. It was done by one vote. We'll look at that next Monday night. Thank you all for coming.